From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Pitchers and catchers have reported, outfielders and infielders too, and even the designated hitters, but I think it's not quite spring training until Tim Kirkjian reports. Don't you agree? Ahead on Only a Game, a Major League Baseball season preview, and a conversation with Deadspin editor Will Leach, who's also the author of a new book titled God Save the Fan. Also ahead, a night in the lives of the number one Division II men's basketball team in the country, the 24-0 Bentley Falcons.
We are the same level of play as low Division I. We're a little bit shorter in the front court, but our basketball play is every bit the same as America East, Patriot League, Ivy League, and anybody that doesn't think that is making a mistake.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Groundhog Day, St. Valentine's Day, and President's Day notwithstanding, February is generally a grind, except for the fact that pitchers and catchers report during this month, and then everybody else reports too, and Major League Baseball begins playing games, even though those games don't count, and many of the stadiums where they'll play the games that will count are still not only empty, but windy and cold. Joining me now to anticipate the baseball season for which the teams are at last preparing in Florida and in Arizona is ESPN's Tim Kirkjian. Tim, welcome back to the program.
How are you, Bill?
Tim, last year the Colorado Rockies represented the National League in the World Series, albeit briefly. Are the Rockies still on the way up, or did they peak in October?
I think they're on the way up. I think they've got it figured out now. And that doesn't mean they're going back to the World Series. It doesn't even mean they're going to make the playoffs again. But let's remember how pedestrian that organization was for so long. They were basically irrelevant. And the way they played really from May on last year gave all Rockies fans hope that, you know, this is going to be a sign of things to come. And again, if they win 85 games or something like that this year, that's a good year for them. They've got young kids on the way up, and that really separates them from a lot of other teams.
Elsewhere in the National League, the Dodgers will be managed by Joe Torre. Will he follow up his fine run with the Yankees with an equally productive stint in L.A.?
Well, there's no way he's going to be as good in L.A. as he was in New York. However, I was with the Dodgers for 3 days this spring, Bill, and I'm telling you, as soon as that guy walked in the room, a whole lot of things changed. His presence alone adds so much to the dynamic of that team, especially in the clubhouse. He will never win four rings in L.A., but I could see them going to the playoffs first year under him. Remember, they didn't make it last year because I really believe he's that good.
Up the coast, the San Francisco Giants won't have to contend with the distraction of Barry Bonds. On the other hand, they won't have Bonds as an attraction to sell tickets. Net gain or net loss?
I think it's a net gain, ultimately. They're going to miss him on the field because, Bill, he can still really hit. However, he was a distraction in the clubhouse. There's no way around that. And the players on that team said this spring, there's a lot less pressure around here. There's a lot less media around here. Guys can come out of their shell a little bit because Barry is not here. So they're going to struggle again, but it's not going to be because Barry Bonds is not there. It's going to be because they're starting to rebuild something, and that's going to take a while to do that.
Barry Bonds has let it be known that he's rested and ready for another season. Is any general manager likely to offer him work?
I don't think so, Bill. In fact, I would be shocked if he got a job. Let's keep in mind that he's probably a DH now, not an outfielder. So he's basically cut his teams in half now. Plus, he's been indicted by the federal government. I mean, he's in big trouble when it comes to that. It's a shame in a way, because he could help a lot of teams with the bat, but everything else that comes with him, I don't think is much of a help at all.
In the single most publicized signing of the offseason, the New York Mets acquired some kid pitcher from the Twins. Does this make New York a favorite in the National League East?
Well, it does for me, and I spent 2 days with the Mets this spring, Bill, and I can tell you that Johan Santana, much like Joe Torre, has changed the dynamic in L.A., Johan Santana has changed it with the Mets. Now they bring in not just a number one starting pitcher, they bring in the number one starting pitcher in the game to put on top of their rotation. And yes, to me, it makes them the best team in the National League. Now, of course, keep in mind, I picked the Rockies to finish fifth in their division last year, and they ended up as the best team ultimately in the National League. So I'm not sure we should listen to me again. However, on paper, I really like the Mets, but let's also keep in mind the National League is weak again this year, and it's not the greatest thing in the world to be the best team in the National League right now.
Last year's champs, the Red Sox, have made very few changes in the offseason. Tim, has general manager Theo Epstein been wise to leave things pretty much as they were?
I think so. I love what the Red Sox are doing. If they had upped their offer, they would have Johan Santana on their team right now. But I was in Boston for a couple days this offseason after they won the World Series, and I wasn't surprised by this, but all the fans talked about is how much they love the kids. Let's not trade Jacoby Ellsbury. Let's not trade John Lester. And I think the Red Sox put out inferior deals on purpose just in case the Twins jumped and the Red Sox said, all right, if they're going to take him for that, we'll make the trade. But they're not going to give him anything extra. And I don't think they wanted to trade any of their young kids. And I think they're absolutely thrilled with the team that will open the 2008 season. And frankly, I think they should be thrilled. That's how good they're going to be.
The Blue Jays seem to have improved themselves. The Yankees are under new management, of course. The Tigers roared for a time last season. Have any of them gotten enough better to thrive this summer?
Yeah, I really like what the Tigers did in the offseason, Bill. They made a couple of moves. They got Edgar Renteria to play shortstop, but more important, they brought in Miguel Cabrera to play third base, and they added Dontrelle Willis to their starting staff. Now, we'll see if Willis can find what he's lost the last 2 years, but I promise you, Miguel Cabrera will be a great hitter immediately because that's what he is. He's not a very good third baseman. He doesn't look very good in a uniform these days, but he can really hit, and that's one thing the Tigers did not do the second half of last year. For all their greatness offensively the first half, they did not hit the second half. They will hit in both halves this year, thanks mostly to Miguel Cabrera.
All right, Tim, you've already poisoned the well for yourself earlier in this conversation, but it is time now for your legendarily brilliant preseason picks.
Okay, I'm going to go with the Red Sox, Tigers, and Angels winning the division with the Yankees winning the wild card. I'm going to go with the Mets, the Cubs, the Dodgers winning the divisions, and the Phillies winning the wild card. I've got the Mets playing the Red Sox in the World Series, and I've got the Red Sox beating the Mets this year.
Okay, well, it's that'll be good news to all sorts of people within the sound of my voice. Not so good to people down
and
in New York.
Please keep the tape, Bill, so we can play it back at the end of the year to see how many I got wrong.
You can count on it. ESPN's Tim Kirkshen educates me about baseball from time to time. Thanks very much, Tim.
My pleasure, Bill. See ya.
Happy holiday for drink.
On Tuesday night, before 1,078 basketball fans, the Bentley College Falcons took on the Assumption College Greyhounds in Waltham, Massachusetts. Yes. Though Assumption came into the game a respectable 19-8 and 13-7 in the Northeast 10 Conference, Bentley, known primarily as a business school, was favored. No surprise for a team that was not only leading the conference, but also riding a 51-game regular season winning streak.
Final score, Bentley 79, Assumption 66.
The victory over Assumption enabled Bentley, ranked number one in the country since late November, to tie the record for consecutive regular season wins by a Division II men's team. The Falcons last lost when they met Winona State, a Minnesota powerhouse, in Division II's Elite Eight last spring. One of those most responsible for Bentley's success is a 6'4" junior guard named Lou Finnegan from nearby Lexington, Massachusetts. Finnegan began his college career playing for Cal Poly in the Division I Big West Conference. He transferred to Bentley after his freshman year. After Tuesday night's game, I asked Lou Finnegan if he ever worried that prospective employers might dismiss him as a guy who went to a basketball factory rather than a business college.
We got to go to class and everything. It's not like a big time where we just get teachers to do stuff class for us. So
That's what the big time is.
Yeah, that's what the big time schools do. We don't do that. We got to go to class. We got to do all our work.
That from the guard's mouth is one distinction between Division I and Division II. Another is that D2 schools don't have as many athletic scholarships to award. Their games rarely get national television coverage, and the players at Bentley understand that the idea is to graduate and look for work in marketing or management, rather than assume that after freshman year, they'll find employment with the Knicks or the Lakers. Among the current keepers of the Bentley streak is Youssef Abdul Ali, the 5'11 guard from Springfield, Massachusetts, who was homeschooled until he entered a charter high school that didn't have a basketball team until his sophomore year. He's joined on the floor by 6'6 forward Nate Frisch, who finished high school without dazzling any college coaches, so he tried life as a postgrad.
When I was at my prep school year in New Jersey at the Hunt School, I really didn't have much on the table until the spring of that year. To be honest, I was a little bit discouraged, and I ended up playing in a Mercer County All-Star game in New Jersey. Coach Lawson happened to be there looking at a kid who had committed. That kid ended up decommitting, so he needed a forward, called me up, took a train up here, visited, tried out, picked Bentley.
Coach Jay Lawson, the guy who found Frisch when he was scouting somebody else, has been at Bentley for 17 years. He's been successful enough to earn half a dozen Coach of the Year designations, and his teams have won conference championships during the past three seasons. Obviously, Bentley is every opponent's big game, but Coach Lawson denies that all the winning begets pressure.
I don't think it's difficult for us because we won 32 in a row last year, so we have the same situation. We've been through it before.
While the most successful Division I schools are playing for the top seeds in the NCAA tournament, Division II is what Coach Lawson calls a regionalized sport. That means Bentley may play some of the teams in the Northeast 10 Conference three or even four times before earning a tournament berth.
Most of the time in Division II, the top team all regular season doesn't advance because the parity from top to bottom is difficult, and then you get the final eight teams in the region, and they're all capable of beating us, and some of them haven't for quite a while. So we're up against it, there's no question. So in other words, you don't really look ahead because it's only going to get in your way. It's going to hurt you if you do.
When Coach Lawson and I were speaking in his office after his team had won their 52nd consecutive regular season game, I found myself wondering about that contention. How could a guy who has been so successful at the Division II level not look ahead, maybe all the way to Division I, where the money is so much better and the acclaim so much louder?
I think this is a better situation than most jobs that my friends have had in Division I. A lot of them are no longer in coaching because of the way people treat Division I sports. And we are the same level of play as low Division I. We scrimmage them and we play exhibition games, and we're a little bit shorter in the front court, but our basketball play is every bit the same as America East, Patriot League, Ivy League, and anybody that doesn't think that is making a mistake. So it's a pretty nice place to work.
And then, of course, there's the winning. This afternoon, Bentley will visit St. Michael's College in Colchester, Vermont. When the two teams met in Waltham earlier this season, Bentley won by 32 points. If Coach Lawson's team prevails again, the Falcons will have established the longest regular season winning streak in the history of Division II men's basketball. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Lots of children in Nicaragua are wearing shirts and caps celebrating the perfect season of the New England Patriots. Never mind that the perfect season never materialized since the New York Giants upset the previously undefeated Pats in the Super Bowl. Hundreds of the shirts and caps that had been printed in case New England won were shipped to the southern Nicaraguan city of Diriamba by World Vision, a humanitarian organization which has a deal with the National Football League to distribute stuff celebrating the wrong team. Of that arrangement, Miriam Diaz of World Vision has said the children are the real winners, which will certainly make the Patriots feel better. No, it won't. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce discusses the week's news. But first, more than 300 would-be professional football players have converged this week on Indianapolis, Indiana, hoping to vertical leap, bench press, and 40-yard dash their way onto an NFL team. One prospect with whom you might not be familiar is Tommy Blake, whose hopes were high a year ago when he was considered a top-five pick. But Blake's senior year at Texas Christian University was characterized by erratic behavior, weight gain, and finally treatment for mental illness. Steve Greenberg profiled Blake for this week's edition of the Sporting News, and he joins me now on the line from St. Louis. Steve, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
Let's go back to the beginning of this school year. Tommy Blake returned to TCU for his senior season. How long did it take his coaches, trainers, and teammates to realize that something was wrong?
Well, I think it took several weeks. From everything I've gathered, there was evidence, you know, that he was troubled, that he wasn't himself, and that was right away, and even throughout the off season. You know, these players organized unsupervised workouts, and it's usually led by seniors. And Blake's not only was one of the seniors, but he was the best player on the team, and he did not partake in most of that. And then, you know, once he got to practice, I think there were plain signs, but. You know, in hindsight, it's easy to assess that there was something wrong, and these people are not expert at dealing with this. And so he left the team and came back, and, you know, then he left again. And it wasn't until after he left again that his head coach, Gary Patterson, took the lead on getting him some help. I'm sure he wishes he'd spotted trouble sooner and done something, but that he did it at all, it speaks well of him.
Eventually, Blake was diagnosed with depression and social anxiety disorder. Blake believes that the pressures to turn pro brought on his mental illness. What kind of pressure was Blake under in that final year at college?
Well, you know, it starts before that final year. Everybody wants a piece of a top player, and by that I mean people who want to represent him, people who want to hook him up with an agent. There are a lot of people who can make money off a top prospect. So Blake dealt with that in a growing capacity, probably starting with his sophomore year. But by his senior year, by the summer before it, he says, his agent says, phone calls literally in the hundreds on a daily basis. Mm. And dealing with so many phone calls and people wanting something from him, I just think for him was extraordinarily difficult to process, to weed out who he should be talking to and why versus who he should be ignoring or even running from. People in there, you know, have a draft team or an agent team. They have people who deal with agents and agents' minions, you know, on their behalf. I don't think Blake had somebody like that, and so he was getting all this direct contact, and he didn't really know what to do with it.
Blake spoke with you about his treatment for mental illness, though I understand he was pretty reluctant to do that. His agent, Reggie Ruzan, has convinced Blake that he needs to be upfront about the issue if he hopes to get a decent position in the draft. Is that a good strategy?
It's certainly a good strategy from a football point of view. Blake wouldn't get drafted at all if he sat down with people from the NFL and stonewalled them. He's got to go through this, and there's no reason to assume that in going through this, he's going to set himself back past any point of no return. I mean, people with mental illness still have to confront their daily lives and manage them, and Tommy Blake's no different than that. So he's got some difficult things he has to do, and he's doing them now. You know, he's doing them now at the combine, sitting with people from literally every team in the league probably, and being asked the most personal of questions. And, you know, I hope for his sake he can not only handle that, but become more comfortable with talking about it, because he'll have to talk about it really almost nonstop between now and the draft, and then possibly for years on end.
One of the veteran scouts with whom you spoke said that he would never take a chance on Tommy Blake. He said, and I'm quoting now, "I don't know how you can justify bringing a player in who has mental instability. One thing you have to have to play in the NFL is your head screwed on right each week." Can Blake overcome the stigma of mental illness in the NFL?
Doesn't that really speak to the stigma, that comment? You know, there are so many things that are entertained more casually and routinely by people in the NFL. Criminal behavior leaps right to mind. And just the patterns of you know, poor performance at school, unreliability, things like that, none of which I don't think describe Tommy Blake at all. This stigma is kind of cruel. It's not necessarily in every organization, you know, either. I mean, it's, you know, to use the blanket description of the stigma in the NFL presumes that there aren't individual organizations that are a little more savvy than others about human relations.
Right. Yeah, that's well put, because this was one veteran scout, but he wasn't speaking for all scouts or all teams, obviously.
But he undoubtedly is speaking for a lot of people in the NFL who, mm-hmm. who just, you know, who don't have a lot of experience with this and don't necessarily care to get it.
You say you've been in touch with the people working with Tommy Blake during the combine. Do you have any kind of early sense of how well he is doing?
Well, it's not really at that point yet. He hasn't run yet or lifted yet, and that'll come in the next day. So we'll have to update that. But I mean, it's that information will all be posted on the internet. It's on NFL Network. It'll be very available. So anybody who's interested in how he actually runs, and so that's what we're going to learn about him this week, and then in training camp, as he tries to make a team. He can get drafted. That doesn't guarantee he'll even make a team. He could be out of football 2 months from now permanently.
Well, if that happens, if he either doesn't get drafted or gets drafted and then doesn't make the team that drafts him, what do you suppose happens next?
I know that he loves working with kids. I've heard so many stories about him with kids. There was one story I heard that I found interesting and kind of telling at the Playboy All-American photo shoot gathering. There were activities where players were socializing. Everybody went out. Tommy, he hung back. He hung back and entertained the various PR people's kids. You know, he sat and played video games with them. And what? That's a nice thing. But I don't know if he considers himself grown up yet or if he sees himself as an adult. And he's playing football and living in this grown man's world, and I don't know if he's just quite ready, but you know, I think if he heard that, he would disagree and maybe even be offended. I think the story on Blake is, you know, the surface has been scratched, but there's a lot more to learn about him in the next year.
Steve Greenberg writes for the Sporting News. His profile of Tommy Blake is in the February 18th issue. Steve, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Okay, thank you, Bill.
To experience Only a Game's magical web world, please visit onlyagame.org. The Colorado Rockies, the mountain range, not the 2007 National League champions, draw thousands of visitors from around the world for ski vacations in Aspen and Vail, the state's two most glamorous destinations. But ski enthusiasts are trending towards some of the state's smaller ski slopes in greater numbers, echoing a nationwide trend. From Colorado, Nancy Greenlease reports.
In Colorado, daily ski pass prices have reached a Rocky Mountain high, nearly $90 at Aspen and Vail. So instead, ski bunnies are hopping to slopes like Eldora Mountain, where they can ski and get accommodations for more than $20 less. But the hotels are more than a half hour away, and skiers shouldn't look forward to fine dining on the mountain, or even cloth napkins, according to Eldora marketing director Rob Lind.
On mountain dining. I mean, you know, yeah, we've got a snack shack up top, but it's not glamorous on mountain dining facility. It's a cafeteria with trays, you know, and people don't seem to mind that.
Oh, it's excellent, excellent. Yeah, we're having fun, yeah.
Gwen Hammond stands near the challenge lift, where typical of the smaller resorts, there's no wait. The Australian has skied the big-name resorts in Colorado during visits to the U.S., and for this vacation chose Eldora. She rattles off the benefits.
No people, friendly, small, easy to get to, cheap to get to. Yeah.
How did you get up here?
Bus from Denver, bus up here. $375.
That's a pretty good deal.
That's a good deal, yeah.
This season, Eldora's ski and stay program is expected to grow by more than a third. Some of Colorado's other small resorts report nearly a 20% increase in non-local visitors in recent years. It's a trend that's occurring from New England to California, says Michael Berry of the National Ski Areas Association.
Well, it's been an interesting phenomenon, and I think 10 or 12 years ago, people looked at the small areas and didn't quite know what their future was, but some things have happened that have really changed their destiny to some extent and the destiny of the sport. First of all, snowboarding became incredibly popular, particularly with young people.
And he says the population boomed. Record numbers of children entered kindergarten in the U.S. in the late 1990s, and now they're ready to shred, and they don't care where.
You know, the hills aren't as big, but a lot of these small resorts are focused on younger customers, sometimes principally snowboarders. And the terrain park is the feature of interest. And so for young people, a great terrain park makes a small mountain huge.
Many smaller resorts see as many visitors in a year as the larger ones do in a day. Travel agencies aren't booking these trips, nor are the resorts pumping tons of money into publicity. Jen Butson of Ski Vermont says the smaller resorts are getting some modern help.
This would be the, you know, World Wide Web word of mouth is what you could call it, really. Instead of people going to the one that they always know, they're able to find out, oh, you know, hey, this one's right down the road. This one's half the price. This one's got blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? They're just doing comparisons that they didn't even have any idea about beforehand.
And they're landing in villages like East Burke, Vermont, home of Burke Mountain Ski Area, an acclaimed ski academy, and countless cross-country and snowshoe trails. Downtown has just a few stop signs. That's where Mary Callahan is seeing signs of the new visitors.
People driving terribly. People swerving all over the road and rushing through stop signs and, you know, just parking sideways and general lack of etiquette.
She's not complaining too much since these cars bring skiers that fill the five condos that she manages. Callahan says the out-of-staters are attracted by Burke Mountain's low-key feel.
I think it's really old school. It's a smaller place. Harder to lose your kids, and it's never crowded is the best thing that I can say, and obviously that won't last forever.
The company that bought Burke Mountain a few years ago plans to build more than 1,000 homes and condos, a golf course, a spa, and other amenities. Many view the Ginn Company's development as key to the mountain's survival. Skiers need places to sleep and eat in this rural area. Lift tickets alone haven't paid the bills. Burke Mountain weathered repeated bankruptcies in the 80s and 90s. Callahan says locals chew over the development with their morning donuts downtown.
And you can sort of see the divisiveness. You see people on one side, people on the other side. People that are thinking, you know, money, you know, finally my land's going to be worth something. And then a lot of people that are really concerned with the character of the town and what's going to happen to little old Burke when all of a sudden we have all these people here.
In Colorado, environmentalists are concerned about the gobbling up of more terrain for skiing and sleeping. Ryan Bidwell, executive director of Colorado Wild, warns that small resort development, coupled with the boom at the larger resorts, will have a snowball effect.
They all grow closer and closer together, and the spaces in between gets proportionately smaller and smaller. That has impacts in terms of wildlife's ability to move through the area. It certainly has cumulative impacts on things like water quality, water quantity.
Back at Eldora, development hasn't yet encroached on the mountain. A public bus waits to take out-of-staters down to Boulder. Rick Steele of Sarasota, Florida, will drive an hour to stay with friends. The former Coloradan used to ski at the larger resorts, but with a family and budget, he's scaled down, but doesn't feel as if he's sacrificed anything.
Heck no, no, not at all. Definitely a little mellower and not so glitzy, which is fine. The snow here today is just as good as any other resorts.
For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenlace in Denver.
You're listening to Only a Game. Last week, I spoke with Professor of Anthropology Tom Porcello, who has recorded the sounds of various Major League ballparks, compared said sounds, and drawn various conclusions. Patricia Brenner, who lives in Columbus, Ohio, emailed to say, "The first recording you played was from Cleveland, and as far as I know, you didn't identify it, but I said to myself, that sounds like Cleveland. This truly amazes me because I am not the biggest baseball fan and have not been inside Jacobs Field or the old Cleveland Stadium more than a dozen times altogether. What a wonderful idea that gentleman had." Ann Landis, who hears the program on WRNI in Rhode Island, was less impressed by Professor Porcello. "It doesn't take a doctorate to recognize the difference between the sounds of a Red Sox game at Fenway Park and a minor league game at McCoy Stadium in Pawtucket," she wrote. "There is a much higher pitch emanating from the fans from McCoy because families can actually afford to take their children to see the Pawtucket Red Sox. It's hard to count the number of mistakes I made last week when I foolishly stumbled into the world of auto racing. Mike Z, a WBUR listener, John Potts, who hears the program on WXXI in Rochester, New York, and Dave Snow, who listens to WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, are among those scolding me for calling Dario Franchitti Dario Franchetti. Blake Dolson, who hears the program on WFYI in Indianapolis and thus should know, wrote, "I listen to your show every week and I love it, but whenever a stick and ball sports show tries to report on motorsports, I cringe. Dario Franchitti has never been an F1 driver. He drove in the IRL series and won the Indy 500. Keep the intramural donkey soccer Northwest Division League stories coming." From the other side of the aisle, Andrea Parsons of Buffalo, New York, emailed to say, "My favorite part of the program is Charlie Pierce because he is an avid non-NASCAR fan." This observation will doubtless irk Mr. NASCAR. Perhaps I won't tell him about it. And finally, Paul Lowe, who hears the program on WVPS in Burlington, Vermont, wrote to say, "I was also wrong when I said last week that Thomas Dold had run up the stairs in the Empire State Building faster than anybody else. Mr. Lowe says Paul Craik turned in a faster time in 2003. Apologies to both Mr. Lowe and Mr. Craik. I'm sorry, I got my stories mixed up. Get it? Stairs? Stories? Anyway, send your complaints about bad puns, corrections, questions, and other communications to us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can contact us through the website, onlyagame.org, or leave a message on the listener line at 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's the last great challenge on Earth. Maybe, except that the beginning of the challenge movie stuntman Steve Trulia has in mind will transpire 24 miles above the Earth. Mr. Trulia, a former soldier, proposes to undertake a record-breaking skydive by jumping out of a hot air balloon that will have ascended to 3 times the cruising altitude of a jumbo jet. Mr. Trulia will be wearing a pressurized spacesuit. He will be in free fall for 7 minutes before opening his parachute, at which point he may have broken the sound barrier. He acknowledges that he has no idea how his body will react. What a good idea. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, fans unite against various injustices, or they don't, and they just enjoy the game. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Tonight in Memphis, the number one Division I college basketball team in the nation will host the number two Division I basketball team in the nation. Does Memphis remain number one, or does Tennessee grab that distinction?
I think Memphis may beat them, and I think John Calipari has moved heaven and earth and a number of NCAA regulations, possibly, to put this team together. And this is his one shot. And I think they're actually better than Tennessee is. And I think it's the biggest thing to happen to Memphis State basketball since they played UCLA for the title. So, yes, I believe they win.
Elsewhere in Tennessee basketball, Candace Parker plans to leave campus before she has used up all of her basketball eligibility. And strangely enough, Coach Pat Summitt, whose graduation rate is said to be 100%, is not complaining very much. Why is that?
Because her graduation rate is still 100%.
Absolutely.
Ms. Parker has already graduated and already made the Olympic team. So I think all accounts are in balance at Tennessee.
Duke suffered a historic loss against Miami on Wednesday. If things continue to go the way they've been going for men's basketball at Duke, how long does Coach Krzyzewski keep his job?
Oh, 2059, I'd say. And get back to me then.
They gave up a
15-0 run to Miami and dropped their second in a row. They do not rebound the ball very well. They're very vulnerable inside, and that will cost them not merely in this game but down the road in the tournament, I believe.
The NBA trade deadline approached and receded on Thursday, Charlie. What do you make of the 11-player three-way trade designed to make LeBron James happy and the Cavaliers successful in the playoffs?
I'm parsing it through now. As near as I can tell, Cleveland got Bill Russell and Tom Heinsohn and Dolph Schayes.
And Wilt Chamberlain.
And Wilt Chamberlain. And Chicago hired James to make—this is really unfathomable. All I need to know is that Cleveland got rid of Larry Hughes, Drew Gooden, Cedric Simmons, and Shannon Brown, all of whom, except possibly Hughes, is the living definition of dead weight. And they picked up Wally Szczerbiak, who can shoot, and Delonte West, who's a good, useful player. I think Cleveland did all right for themselves.
It was reported from Clearwater, Florida this week that Ryan Howard of the Philadelphia Phillies was walking around with a little extra spring in his step. Why was that?
He's the all-time arbitration champion, Bill. He was awarded $10 million, having already turned down an offer of $7 million, so he's a $3 million champion. Having been the MVP in 2006, it probably makes a lot of sense.
Okay, but wait, listen, is that the sound of Marvin Miller giggling in the background?
Hey, Marvin Miller was never a big fan of arbitration because he thought it was loaded towards the management side, which if you go down the list, it actually is. But this is a really big win for the player side.
These days, Major League Baseball players have year-round personal trainers. They don't need spring training for the most part to get in shape, but that's not to say that there is no reason for spring training, because it's a great time for pranks, and Phillies pitcher Kyle Kendrick was the victim of a beauty this week, don't you think?
Well, if somebody doesn't give him a shirt with the name Kobayashi Iwamura on the back right now, I'll be very disappointed in American baseball players. He was told, and a whole bunch of people were in on this, including a camera crew, that he had been he had been traded to the Yomiuri Giants for a player named Kobayashi Iwamura. And of course, now this is immortalized on YouTube for the next 1,000 years.
The beauty of this on YouTube, by the way, is there's actually a photographic evidence of this poor guy signing a paper. Which apparently he signed and agreed to go to Japan, even though you can't make these
things.
Well,
Charlie Manuel, the manager of the Phillies, is really a mean guy. He wanted to see him get on the airplane. The prank wasn't over until this guy got off the plane, showed up at the Yomiuri Giants ballpark, and discovered he wasn't wanted there either.
Meanwhile, Hank Steinbrenner, the senior vice president of the New York Yankees, said this week that football has a bigger problem with performance-enhancing drugs than baseball does. Will the all-seeing eye of Congress now be cast NFL-ward?
I doubt it very seriously. The NFL swings a lot more weight in Congress than Major League Baseball does. And the problem with saying football has a steroid problem is football is not possible without some sort of drug one way or another. So that probably doesn't have a problem.
I think when magicians do this, there's a term for it.
It's called misdirection.
Yeah, that's it. Shiny things. Look.
Look, shiny keys. Shiny keys over here. Pay no attention to Mr. Clemens. No. Shiny keys.
Barry Bonds filed a complaint this week which asserts that typographical errors on a recent court filing diminish his chance for a fair trial. Trial. That was the typo, at least in this question.
You know, if you've got a high-profile case, proofread the damn documents, please, so you don't have to go through an endless round of motions on why you didn't.
This week, National Football League Commissioner Roger Goodell sent a letter to United States Senator Orrin Hatch, R. Utah, promising the league will not take legal action against churches that show the Super Bowl on large-screen televisions. Is this a violation of the 28th Amendment guaranteeing the separation of church and really good entertainment?
Oh, good for you, Raj. You know? You give him the one. This is the sound of one hand clapping for you, Raj. Very nice. You avoid a public relations disaster. Well done.
The U.S. runners, jumpers, throwers, etc. heading to Beijing for the Olympics this summer will be accompanied by 25,000 pounds of lean meat and enough food for 6,000 meals. What do U.S. Olympic officials have against Chinese food?
Well, no Kung Pao chicken for the U.S. They'll send out for American food. Actually, they're worried about reports of a heavy use of drugs and insecticide in the food production in China. See, I think the way the country is working now, we only want the tainted food if we import it and give it to our kids.
Tainted ourselves.
Not our athletes, though. If we import it and give it to our kids, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But we don't want our athletes picking it up over there right off the shelves when the pesticides are, you know, fresh.
Were you surprised to see that the people looking for a tennis player involved in gambling have finally found one?
No, and actually, we've got Giorgio Gallimberti, who hinted that he was actually betting on himself, but never to lose.
It's the old
so don't
Pete
worry
Rose
about that.
Defense.
Exactly.
Finally, Charlie, few pro athletes get permission to take time out from training for reasons relating to the supernatural, but I guess that that is the case for Manuel Almunia, Arsenal's goalkeeper.
His house is haunted, and it's haunted by a monk who his wife saw standing holding a candle over their bed. Apparently, the home was built on the site of a former insane asylum, which is not to be confused from the insane asylum in which Arsenal actually plays its games.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time for Only the Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
If you pine for plentiful podcasts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. Whereas most people who write books having to do with sports would welcome the opportunity to discuss what they've done on ESPN, Will Leach is proud of the fact that he has been blackballed by the All Sports TV network. It says so right on the cover of God Save the Fan, Will Leach's new book, which is subtitled How Preening Sportscasters, Athletes Who Speak in the Third Person, and the Occasional Convicted Quarterback Have Taken the Fun Out of Sports, parentheses, and How We Can Get It Back, end paren. Will Leach, who also writes the blog Deadspin, joins me now in the studio. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me, and congratulations on making it through the subtitle.
It wasn't easy, because even in the age of long subtitles,
yes,
yours is impressive. Tell me about how preening sportscasters et al. Have taken the fun out of sports for you.
Well, I think there's a certain corporatization that's kind of happened to sports a little bit, where the separation between those that work in the world of sports and the people that actually, you know, consume the sports, the, you know, the people that pay for all of this, I think that gap has widened, I think, in the last 10-15 years. And I don't think it's solely the fault of ESPN, though. I think them being as large as they have, as they've contributed to it a lot. But if any other business ran their business the way that I think the world of sports ran their business, I think they'd be out of business.
Of the exhibitionist who takes off his shirt during a football game played in freezing weather to reveal one of the letters of ESPN on his chest, you write, "This is not the typical sports fan." What is the typical sports fan, and how did you decide what the typical sports fan is?
Well, one of the things that's been very exciting for me about doing Deadspin is realizing that the average sports fan is the average American. They're often very professional. They work. One of the ongoing jokes we have on the site is the Deadspin LLP. Whenever there's a legal issue, I'll call it out to the commenters of Deadspin LLP. So now you know exactly where all your billable hours are going. They're going to read blogs and comment on blogs. And a lot of times when people work in sports, the only time they ever really come in contact with the people that are just the average hardcore sports fans are either when they're sending them angry emails, they're listening to talk radio, or they're seeing those cameras at the games with the guys with the ESPN pin on their chest. I think the average sports fan is much more intelligent than that, and I think that's kind of a stereotype of fans. I remember when ESPN Magazine did their recent story of the fans issue. I think ESPN Magazine is actually a pretty good magazine, but I remember when they...
Is that going to come back to bite you? I mean, you're making a career out of attacking ESPN,
you know,
my friend.
I think we can get to that in a moment, but I remember when they talked about the idea of having the fan issue. I'm like, you know what? I bet the cover is going to be a shirtless guy that's tubby, screaming into the camera. And you know, I have tons of friends that are sports fans. I've literally never met any of those people. I'm not sure that's really indicative of what fans actually are. They're Americans like everybody else.
Well, elsewhere in the book, you maintain that, quote, being a sports fan means investing a ludicrous amount of time and mental energy into something that bears no relevance to real life. Is there no such thing as a healthy person who is also a fan? fan? Because that sounds like an unhealthy obsession to me, the way you've defined it.
But see, I actually think that's actually healthier. I think that, like, it's understanding that, like, this is entertainment. I can't think of anything else in the world that will make me spontaneously jump up and just start screaming, except for maybe a spider. And I think that...
you can't count on them. Yeah. They don't have schedules.
I know. They never go into extra innings, spiders, either. And there's something, one of the wonderful things about sports. And I think fans are better at keeping that in perspective than I think they're given credit for. I think you become obsessed for a certain period of time, and then you go back to your life. And I think the reason the obsession happens is because it is escapism. It is entertainment. It's something you can kind of dip into, enjoy, and then step away and go back to your life, which I think is another reason there's a little bit of a separation sometimes between the people that work full-time in the world of sports and the people that actually consume the sports.
Does the typical sports fan hate the Olympics, or is that just you?
I might dislike them more than the average fan, but I do think that there's just something somewhat archaic almost about the Olympics anymore. Certainly the last Summer Olympics, when essentially we were being asked to ignore the internet during the day.
And because we weren't supposed to know who won.
We weren't supposed to know what happened. So we're basically getting glorified highlight packages told as if they were real and stopped in the middle with one of those soft-focused, dramatic, hero worship type of pieces. And another thing I find kind of interesting is that as Americans, we love underdogs. I think it's very core to our being as we love to root for the scrappy underdogs. In the Olympics, Americans are never the underdogs.
Well, in only selective sports.
Yes, yes, yes. And
they're never on TV.
Yeah. Or we invent a sport that we're really good at, and all of a sudden, hey, the half pipe is now an Olympic sport.
Absolutely.
And I feel like maybe as Americans we should go ahead and say, we have everything else. You guys can have the luge.
Well, I understand your objections to the Olympic Games. They're political, they're commercial. The U.S. has packed them with sports that athletes from this country can win. There's no question about that. Still, some fans can put all that aside and enjoy the athleticism of the competitors. You, on the other hand, say that you're only thrilled when a figure skater falls down. What is wrong with you?
Yeah, well, I think that's probably my more personal thing. I think that, like, the Olympics is going to have to change a little bit in the next coming years. Because I think most enjoyment, I get some enjoyment from the Olympics too, but I think it's mostly almost for nostalgia purposes. We all remember the great 84 Olympics, and it was a very strange thing during the Winter Olympics in 2006 to pretty much have to pretend when you were watching the Olympics that you didn't actually know what happened. And it's something that when you think of the great moments in Olympic history, of course being the Miracle on Ice being a great example of that, I mean, that's something that wouldn't happen now. We would already know what happened, and that big drama wouldn't be there. And I think that's in a way why they're a little bit almost a relic in a lot of ways, an enjoyable relic in some ways, but I think maybe not necessarily the way people consume sports now.
Well, you're certainly backing off your contention that you're only thrilled when a figure skater falls down.
I do love it when a figure skater falls. I'm not going to lie to you. As someone that I will confess not getting a large part of enjoyment of the beauty of figure skating, the falling down I do find kind of amusing.
In the introduction to God Save the Fan, you say fans just have to, quote, take charge and realize our power. It's almost a call to arms. But at the end of the book, you write that we should just see sports as a respite from life's unpleasant aspects and enjoy sports for what they are. Have you given up by the end of the book, or is there a conflict here?
It took a long time to write it. I lost all my spirit. But by the end, I was like, okay, is this thing over? And I think that...
How many pages do I have to give these people?
I think you could actually have both, actually. I think a great example of fans actually having a little bit of power is actually what you saw in the last week of the season with the Giants and the Patriots in the NFL Network game. Mm-hmm. Like, I think 5 years ago, the NFL Network, if it had existed, would have never... Like, that game would have just been on the NFL Network, and there's nothing anyone could have done about it. Now fans, like, it's easier for fans... I wouldn't say mobilize, because I don't think, like, the protests and so on work so much, but it's easier for when there's a collective scream of, hey, what are you guys
doing? Hey, we want to see this game.
Yeah, when that's a lot easier to be heard than I think it used to be. And to me, that's kind of what I mean in that idea, and that's actually born of the idea of loving sports and enjoying them for what they are. It always seems very backwards to me when networks will make their games harder to be seen, make their product less available in a lot of ways. As a kid, I grew up watching the St. Louis Cardinals games all the time for free, and I assure you, they've certainly got their money's worth out of me over the last couple decades.
You expend a good deal of energy banging on ESPN, which is okay, I guess, except that one of the chapters in the book is titled Five People Who Offended the Almighty ESPN and Paid the Price. Aren't you afraid that you'll be squashed like a bug?
I'm not too worried about that because, I think Deadspin's been able to get bigger and the book has been doing okay, but let's not pretend. Like, on my best day, I have 1/1,000th of the traffic and readership that ESPN does. And I think that's actually kind of the thing about ESPN. I don't think that, like, there's so much malicious or actively trying to ruin sports. I think what's kind of what happened is I, like any other sports fan, watch ESPN regularly because there's really no real viable competitor. They have me. I'm not going anywhere. So because of that, you know, they're a corporation. They have to grow. It's not an art project. You know, I certainly understand that. But to grow, they have to kind of go after the more casual fan. So there's inevitable kind of dumbing down or pumping up controversy or making everything kind of a black or white issue in a lot of ways. And I think it's pretty natural for those of us that remember the golden days of ESPN when it was really like Keith Olbermann and Dan Patrick and Craig Kilborn, and we remember like how it was so fresh and really like we were like, wow, this is such a cool new way to work at sports and how exciting that was. And as they've gotten away from that, I think in recent years, I think it's natural that, you know, your most loyal customers are going to have a little bit of a backlash involving that.
Will Leach is the author of God Save the Fan, published by Harper, and he also writes the blog Deadspin, at least until ESPN notices him and crushes him like a bug. Will, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Phil DiMartino, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our Bentley basketball photo gallery or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Bentley guard Youssef Abdul Ali. I asked him if Bentley, a respected business school, was becoming a basketball factory.
Not yet. Hopefully we can get there, but not yet.
Wait, I thought Michael Jordan played at Bentley back in the 80s. Oh, no, that's right. He drives a Bentley. Several of them, actually. All at once, because he is Michael Jordan. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.